Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, join us as we explore heart health and homeopathy, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath Debbie Brook, with Dr. Adil Chimsanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go.
Welcome, everyone. Today is February 27th, 2013. We're rounding out the month of February, and we're going to be coming into March. Hopefully, it will go out like a lamb. And we're going to be speaking with Dr. Adil Chimsanawala Kasim from India today about rashes. That is our topic. And he has provided for us a handout, which you can find on the Blog Talk Radio web page or on Homeopathy World Community. We truly, truly thank everyone who has tuned in to listen live, gotten on the comment, the chat, and sent us messages, and also call in or email to Dr. Adil to ask questions or just thank him for providing this education to us free of charge. And we really thank everyone who has shared either on their Facebook, on their Twitter, on their email, or on their website. You can embed any of these shows and provide that as a service to those people who visit your own website. Today,
hello.
We have lots of things to learn today.
Exactly. I started with one of the sub-rubrics of eruptions of chest chapter, and now we have a full lecture on rashes.
Yes. And we're going to have, you know, I put out on Facebook something that you had written to me as a follow-up to I have to find my web page to open it up and look at it, but I made it something pretty prominent on Homeopathy World Community Facebook page with a beautiful picture of a camellia. You wrote, "Service and sharing are the languages of the hands. Listening and inspiring are the languages of the head. Love and laughter are the languages of the heart. Silence and intuition are the languages of our true nature." And so that was so beautiful. I wanted to share that with more people. And I think a lot of people have taken note of it.
I sincerely hope, and if people have taken note of it, I hope that people bring it in their practice, in their daily lives, and then the entire adage will come true.
We need it. And I also received one other quote. This is by Martin Luther King. It says, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." So we have to leave the space in our heart, in our mind, for love and fill it with that. Think something positive all the time. Think the best of other people.
Exactly. And both of the quotes are very true. And day in and day out, people who practice and follow such quotes, they experience and they know how true they are in real life.
Yes. So we want to thank you for spending time with us. And I will be checking into the chat for if anybody who tunes in and sends us a comment.
Exactly. And before we start on, I know that the chapter of Rash or the PowerPoint presentation which I have sent is quite an exhaustive one. Hopefully we should be able to complete it in an hour. And I've taken many drugs so that we can differentiate and learn more about the drugs and the rashes. But before that, we have to honor a very, very senior Indian homeopath, and he is none other than Dr. Mahendra Lal Sarkar. It is said about him that none amongst the great men of modern India is better entitled than the subject of this brief sketch, whether regarded as a physician, a patriot, or as a man who had made considerable personal sacrifice for truth and his country. He is none other than Dr. Mahendra Lal Sarkar. Few among the noteworthy persons of a country, that is India, would more assiduously shrink from the public gaze or shun with a more sensitive persistency the fierce light which in this prying age beats upon the inner lives of eminent men. But a man of his transcendent merit, as a successful practitioner of the healing art, as an erudite scholar, as an eminent scientist, fired with zeal for the regeneration of his country, through the agency of science, must necessarily be before the public, and that public was, in his case, almost worldwide. Dr. Mahendra Lal Sarkar was known not only throughout India, but his fame spread to Europe and America. His advice was asked even from Australia. This man was born of exceedingly poor parents in an obscure village in the name of Paikpara in the district of Howrah in West Bengal on the 2nd of November 1833. At a tender age of 5, he was brought by his mother to Calcutta. Shortly after arrival at Calcutta, his father died at Paikpara when only 32 years old. His mother survived her husband's death for about 4 years, and she too died of cholera when she was hardly 32 years of age. So this young man, a young boy, lost both his parents at a very, very early age. While as yet at school, science had thoroughly marked him for his own. He used to read Milner's Tour Through Creation, a popular scientific work, with an avidity which was remarkable for a lad of his tender years. Dr. Sarkar entered the medical college in 1855, where he remained for 6 years. There, he attracted the attention of Dr. Archer, then the professor of ophthalmology. And this professor was so impressed by Sarkar's knowledge that Sarkar was asked to attend his clinic every single day. At the request of senior students and with the permission of the professors and the principal, Sarkar, during his studentship, delivered a course of lectures on optics in order to enable the students to better understand the mechanism of the eye as an optical instrument. In this year, he delivered a lecture at the meeting of the Bethune Society on the adaptation of the human eye to distance. His career in medical college was a brilliant one. He obtained medals, prizes and scholarships in botany, physiology, medicine, surgery, midwifery. He was sometimes ahead of some of his professors in information in their own specialities. In the same year that Sarkar obtained his MD degree, a medical association was established in Calcutta through the exertions of late Dr. Chakrabarty under the name of Bengal Branch of the British Medical Association. At the opening meeting of this association, Dr. Sarkar, in the course of a long and fervent speech, denounced homeopathy as one of the systems of quackery. I repeat again, at the opening meeting of this association, Dr. Sarkar denounced homeopathy as one of the systems of quackery. I am reminded very much of Herring. Sarkar's opinion regarding homeopathy changed while he was holding the latter office. On being asked by a friend to review Morgan's philosophy of homeopathy for a local lay journal, he promised to do it at once. But the perusal of it convinced him that he could find and should give no opinion on the book before subjecting homeopathy to a practical trial. I believe same as Haring did. But not knowing it practically himself, he could not conscientiously try it. Fortunately, at that time, Babu Rajendra Dutt, a philanthropic lay Bengali gentleman who had given him Morgan's pamphlet to read, was practicing homeopathy in Calcutta. Dr. Sarkar did not think it infra-dick to watch cases under this gentleman, and the result was the conviction that homeopathy medicines, the so-called infinitesimal nothings, did act, and act beneficially in removing the disease. He thought it his duty to lay this result of his investigation of homeopathy before the profession, and to recant what he had said in ignorance of the system at the opening meeting of the Bengal branch of the British Medical Association. He accordingly read an address in medicine at his fourth annual meeting held on 16 February 1867. And I quote, "On the supposedly uncertainty in medical science and the relation between diseases and the remedial agents," unquote.
So he had many similar problems with the community accepting homeopathy, but he persisted.
Exactly, because this was his turning point. He did not, like Haring, who also came into homeopathy because he had to review an article. He had to speak something about homeopathy. But both of these geniuses, they thought it wiser to practice homeopathy and then criticize instead of directly criticizing them on the face of it. And once this gentleman was convinced about homeopathy, for several months from the day following the fourth annual meeting of the Bengal branch of British Medical Association, the man who had such a large and extensive practice did not receive a single call. Some of his best friends, finding that he had ruined his bright prospects for what they believed was a delusion, became suspicious of his sanity. That means he was regarded as an insane person. And he was totally disgusted with the approach of his colleagues of this time. And that was the time, in 1868 January, he started one of very, very famous journals in Indian medicine, and that was the Calcutta Journal of Medicine. And he continued to edit it to the day of his death.
So do we learn the character trait of persistence and going forth no matter what? I mean, today we have whistleblowers in the traditional medical community who are being defamed, whose reputation is being ruined, who are losing their livelihood through these kinds of campaigns against them.
Exactly, because the lives of great, reading the lives of these great men and these stalwarts, we also get inspired. I mean, there are times when we feel frustrated that every time you can't keep on explaining things in a modern language to modern medicine people or to people of other field or to so-called scientists. And then that is the time these lives inspire. Because though by his adoption of homeopathy he was plunged in hot controversy and engaged single-handedly in a fierce struggle against a powerful orthodoxy, Dr. Sarkar did not forget what he had been long impressed with, that his country could only be regenerated through the cultivation of sciences. And he regarded homeopathy as a very viable science. And so a scientist turning to homeopathy was a very, very big asset to homeopathy. He became an asset to homeopathy, and till the last day of his death, he kept on continuing practicing homeopathy. Then later, after 10 years or so, he was appointed as a fellow of the Calcutta University in 1879. And in recognition of the scholarship and varied attainments, he was placed on Faculty of Arts and was appointed Sheriff of Calcutta in 1887. Being a Sheriff of Calcutta, he was in a very, very highly placed position, wherein he really did give homeopathy a great boost. From then on became the golden era of homeopathy in West Bengal.
Very good.
Three successive lieutenant governors, Sir Rivers Thompson, Sir Stuart Bailey, and Sir Charles Elliott, he was appointed member of the Bengal Legislative Council from 1887 to 1893. Again, being a very, very, being in a wonderful position, he had substantiated homeopathy. He had established colleges in homeopathy. In 1883, the Government of India, in recognition of his services in the cause of science, decorated him with the insignia of Companionship of the Indian Empire, a very, very high equivalent Nobel laureate of that time. And thereafter, the life of Dr. Mahendralal Sarkar was totally upscale. He received a degree of Doctor of Law. He became the Vice Chancellor, and many more such positions were there for this gentleman. And finally, it was on 24th of February 1904, because of recurrent malarial fever and bronchial asthma, this gentleman passed away. And for him, it is said that he was not only the greatest homeopath of his time in India, but also a great scientist. Dr. Ghosh, he has penned out certain lines for this man, and he says, I quote, "Who risen from the ranks by wealth of mind and noble poverty, itself who sowed in gloom and reaped in light, successful tiller of the richest fields of knowledge, noble builder of the dome, when science spreads a living influence over his fatherland, kindly heals, savior of suffering humanity by art, instinct with heavenly mercy, love and grace, this is none other than Dr. Mahendralal Sarkar." So my tributes to this great man who has been a foundation of establishment of the science and art of homeopathy, for which today we are thankful, because we are actually enjoying only the fruits, and these people had to actually labor during the times to establish homeopathy.
So do you feel today in India that you say you're reaping the fruits of all of the what he has paved the road before you? Do you feel as if you are not being challenged in the same ways that he was time?
No, exactly. Homeopathy has got a great place in homeopathy in India, because it is equivalent to the degree of homeopathy, BHMS, Bachelor of Homeopathic Medicine and Surgery, is equivalent to MBBS, that is an allopathic degree. And it is a 5.5 years course, and the degree carries the same importance, the same registration, and the same social status which an allopathic degree does. So it is because of such people that we are blessed with such a degree.
More freedom to practice.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I think everybody's waiting to study about the rashes, and there is a PDF file attached right there on the page that you can open and follow along.
Okay, so we were studying the rubric of eruptions from the chapter of chest on the page 830 from Kent's repertory. We had already finished off many of the eruptions, but now specifically there's a rubric or sub-rubric called as rash. And I thought, I mean, rash is such a colloquial term for eruptions. So it was better for me to take a complete chapter or a complete devote one full time lecture on rash. So rash is nothing but a change of the skin. Now the change on the skin or of the skin can be pertaining to its color, or the appearance of the skin, or the texture of the skin. Any of these changes on the skin or of the skin can be attributed as a rash. Now this rash can be localized to the chest, or it may be spreading all over. The rash may cause the skin to change color, may cause the skin to itch, become warm, become bumpy, become chapped, dry, cracked, blistered, swollen, or maybe painful. Now, if we get any of these or all of these, then it helps us in homeopathy to select remedies. And over a period of number of slides, we'll be telling you how we are going to select homeopathic remedies for various types of rashes. The common causes for rashes, one of the most common cause in medical terminologies, rashes are referred mostly to urticaria and at the most eczema. You can have other types of rashes also, but the commonest are urticaria and eczema. So the commonest causes for rash would be anxiety. A simple anxiety may not lead to palpitations in some people, may not lead to heaviness of headache, head or may not lead to excessive sweating, but they can lead to rashes, anxiety. Then many people have allergies to food, to dyes, cosmetics, drugs, insect bites, metals like zinc, nickel. Many females, I ask, they can't wear earrings made of other metals other than gold. The moment they put on silver or any other metal, their ears start itching or getting suppurated. So these can present as hives, or these can present as allergic rashes or urticaria. Or if the skin is coming in direct contact with some irritant, maybe chemical, maybe clothes, maybe some biological agents, maybe physical agents like sun, again you can have rashes. One of the very, very common reasons for rashes is vaccination. Vaccination to drugs, vaccinations can cause allergic rashes in great number of patients, people. Now, this is significantly downplayed by the Orthodox school, but then we know and we have got innumerable remedies for rashes appearing because of vaccination, or what we call as bad effects of vaccination. We are going to see over a period of time what the remedies are. Then we can have eczema or acne. Now, acne per se is not a rash. But sometimes what happens is, once the acne or pimple comes out, it bursts, and the sebum or the pustular fluid inside the acne, it falls on the surrounding skin. And the skin becomes allergic to that, and then you can have a rash around an acne. Then you can have sunburn or heat or photosensitivity, which is a very, very common phenomena. Tanning, it starts with tanning and may progress on to blisters. Then you can have friction due to chafing of skin. Many females experience rashes during menses, before the menses starts or moment the flow starts. Pregnancy, a very, very common cause again, wherein you can have rashes, particularly on the chest, particularly on the abdomen. You can have rashes of various types. Then ringworms, secondary syphilis, which is nowadays not seen in many, many parts of the world, both developing and developed countries. Lyme disease, yes, Lyme disease, I'm not going to go into there because it's going to take me on a long time. It's a zoonotic disease caused by a bacteria called Borrelia burgdorferi. Not common in this part of our the world, but still, it causes a rash and is identified by the typical rash of the Lyme disease. Scarlet fever, a very, very common fever, where you get fever with rash. It has been common since Hahnemann's time, and before that also, right from Hippocrates' time, scarlet fever has been a very, very common phenomenon. Psoriasis, another common skin diseases. It is basically not a disease of the skin, it is disease on the skin. It's basically an internal allergy manifesting first on the skin, then once the skin is suppressed or after 10-15 years, the disease may manifest in the lungs, the kidneys, the joints. So skin is just one organ of manifestation of psoriasis. It is not the disease of the skin, it is disease on the skin. And then lead poisoning wherever it is relevant. So these are there may be many others, but these are common causes found in clinical practice which you can attribute to rashes.
And there is a website, Unleaded, because of the fact that you think that we've cleaned up our environment, we haven't. Lead is all over.
It's really all over. I mean, it's there in the petrol, it's there in so many places. I mean, it's difficult to... It is becoming part of the environment. That's why so many people are prone to such allergies. For example, I've been born and brought up in India. Right from birth, I've been here. But suddenly, from the same environment, I start getting allergic rhinitis or some rash. And I don't know why. I just keep on wondering why. My food is same. My daily routine is same. Then still, why I'm allergic to this? Why this allergy is miasmatic in nature? Of course, we are not going to touch on that topic because many people would not know what miasm is. Well, all said and done, if a patient of rash comes, or if you want to go to a doctor with rashes, what sort of history would you want to give to a homeopath? People come and give us all sorts of history, but then we are not interested in any and everything. We would be interested in the onset. How did the rash start? Whether it was sudden onset, generally it's because of urticaria, or it was a slow onset. Causation. Do you have a particular causation? For example, doc, last night I had prawns, and this morning I have started getting hives. So do I have a particular cause? Or I happen to eat some stale food, and now I'm getting rashes on the abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
Once the rashes have started, is it localized on that particular part, or are they spreading to different areas? Then what increases the rash? For example, once I start having rash, I may not like to go in the sun. Going in the sun increases the itching on my rash, or going in the sun increases the rash. So that is a specific modality, what we call aggravation by, and that needs to be reported to a homeopath. It may not be important for an allopath, but it is very, very important for a homeopath which factors aggravate the rash or increase the rash and which factors decrease the rash. For example, if I'm better by covering, my rash is better by covering, or the symptoms of the rash are better by covering, then it's a very, very important symptom for a homeopath to be told. Along with it, the rash, you also have to tell what are the other symptoms, like do you have it itching, do you have a fever, do you have a running nose, likewise. So again, this is important. You also have to report the different medications you are taking, you are already on or you are taking, and the suspected medication. You see, you may be a hypertensive male or female, and you may be taking an antihypertensive drug since a long time, but lately the company has changed. For example, you may be taking atenolol of a company A, and because of lack of that production, you may be taking same atenolol of company B. So, moment you have started atenolol of company B, you have started getting that rash. So, this needs to be told to the physician. Then, what sort of occupation you are in, or change of occupation, change of place. For example, you have initially, basically a resident of North Carolina, and suddenly moving to New York for some reason. So you have changed of place, and since you've moved to New York, you're getting a rash. So such things have to be reported. Obviously, the homeopath is going to ask you this question, but then from your end, from the patient's end, this history is important. Contact with animals, a very, very frequent cause of rashes. Pets, wild animals, of course, wild animals, I don't know how many people come in contact with it. Pets, yes. Particularly when they are breeding, particularly when they, for example, dogs, their hair are coming out. In those phases, if you get in contact, or if you've got parrots or other birds, so if you get in contact with such animals or their excreta, then you need to tell them. Then, of course, complete physical examination will be done by a homeopath. In an examination, then this is for doctors. This is for technicians or technical people. What are you going to examine as far as rash is concerned? You have to see the appearance, whether it is a purpura. Purpura means a bluish colored rash. It may be because of a vasculitis or meningococcal disease. It may be a fine sandpaper like rash, like in scarlet fever. Or you can have circular lesions with a central depression, like a molluscum contagiosum. Molluscum contagiosum is a viral infection, and it's called as a pearl, as if rashes are in the form of small pearls, pearly nodules, and they're very hard and you can't break it open. Then you can have numerous plaques with silver scales, which is very, very prominent of psoriasis. So by the appearance, you can decide what sort of rash or what sort of disease the person or the patient is coming with. Again, if it is not prominent, you can also decide, you see the distribution. For example, scarlet rash, fever rash becomes confluent and forms bright red lines in the skin, creases of the neck, the armpits, the groins, and these lines are technically called as Pasteur's lines. Then vesicles of chickenpox, they follow the hollows of the body along the spine, shoulder blades, etc. Very few rashes affect the palms of the hands and soles of the feet. And of them, the most prominent is syphilis. Syphilis characteristically affects the palms of the hands and soles of the feet. Rickettsia, again, rickettsia is a lesser known disease in this part of the world. Rocky Mountain fever, again, which I have not mentioned here, but I think Arizona and places like that, you have got Rocky Mountain fever. Hand, foot and mouth disease is again a very, very common disorder, but more in animals and less in human beings.
And I just updated on the Homeopathy World Community the article about gonorrhea, and this also has rash.
Yeah, gonorrhea also has got rash, but is mainly restricted to the mucocutaneous junctions. The mucocutaneous junction, that is, for example, the oral cavity, the perioral region, or the area around the vagina, or the vulva, or the penile region, or the anus, perianal region. These are the favorite sites for gonorrheal rashes. When we are talking about rashes on the chest.
Okay.
Then we have got examination as far as symmetry is concerned. For example, herpes zoster or shingles. Now, this is a characteristic. This shingles, it affects only one side of the chest and does not cross the midline. It takes one dermatome or one nerve and the entire nerve till it is completely affected. The infection does not leave the nerve. So, it is one-sided basically. So, that also helps us what sort of rashes we have got. So, we have got various drugs, host of drugs. I have tried to cover most and I added certain very, very important drugs for rashes. I have combined, I have incorporated the rubrics from the chapter of skin rashes, and of course not all drugs, but then most of the drugs I have just tried to discuss. And we start with one of the most famous drug, and that is belladonna. The picture here shows a very a child which is smiling in spite of getting a rash. Now this is very rare in belladonna. Basically belladonna is a very lively person, but only when patient is when a person is not a patient. Once the person becomes a patient, then belladonna is not a lively drug. The rash of belladonna may be on the chest. It is generally on the chest. Of course, belladonna rashes are generally on the chest, but anywhere on the body always has a smooth, shiny redness of the skin. And it imparts a burning sensation to the examining hand. But to the patient, it is not. On the other hand, when we see apis, then the actual rash burns and the patient complains of burning. But the belladonna would not complain of burning. But when you touch the patient, touch specifically the rash, then you have a burning sensation on your examining hand. The rash of belladonna generally starts suddenly and it spreads suddenly and goes away suddenly. So it is said that it comes as a storm and goes away like a storm. It is very typical of belladonna and it is invariably accompanied with high grade fever. So such a type of rash you would generally see in eruptive fevers like measles, like rubella, and other sites, cat scratch disease, when the rash comes in suddenly, comes like a storm, high grade fever, the child or the man or the adult, a lady is completely down for 1 or 2 days and the rash leaves without a scar and you don't know that there was ever a rash. This is very typical of belladonna. Belladonna is generally given in the peak of the rash or peak of the fever. We may give 1 or 2 doses in high potency if you are very sure that's a belladonna rash.
Dr. Adil, on slide number 11, where the photo for belladonna is located, it reminds me of a heat rash when, you know, a child, maybe they're out in a hot weather and whether they're back or they're... Is it similar?
Yeah. It is similar, but one can think of belladonna because in heat rash also, for example, in Death Valley in California, wherein you get such type of rashes very frequently, the heat rashes. It is prior to heat stroke or heat exhaustion. You have tremendous exhaustion, high grade fever, and the entire body is completely covered with rash. Therein you have to take cold showers. You give the patient cold showers, icy showers, and the fever reduces. You can also give belladonna. Yes, heat rash can very well be a symptom of belladonna.
And on slide number 12 is the one for APIS, which is,
yeah,
seems as if the eruption kind of runs together and is quite raised.
Yeah. APIS basically is, you see, we have another rubric on page number 831, erysipelas.
Mm-hmm.
So, and APIS is the master drug for erysipelas. But before discussing APIS, we would come to slide number 7, ammonium carb. Are you with me?
Slide number 7. Okay,
yeah.
Ammonium carb. Okay.
And it is a wonder drug. I mean, I would not think, people would not think basically of ammonium carb for erysipelas. A very, very, rather, ammonium carb is not mentioned as a rubric on page number 831 for erysipelas. But when you go to ammonium carb is mentioned on page number 830 in the subrubric of rash as 2 marks remedy. But when you read ammonium carb, it is nothing but erysipelas rash, a very, very common rash. Now, what is this erysipelas? So, we are going to combine the two rubrics and discuss what is erysipelas. Erysipelas is basically an acute streptococcal infection of the dermis. So, we have got 2 layers of the skin, the epidermis and the dermis. And this streptococcal infection involves the entire skin, the dermis, the epidermis and the superficial lymphatics. It generally occurs in the elderly, in infants or people with immune deficiency, or in diabetics who have had diabetes since 10, 15, 20 years and who are on insulin, people who are alcoholics and they do not care about themselves. Erysipelas is a very common infection occurring concurrently with fungal infections, and females who have got impaired lymphatic drainage, like who have undergone mastectomy or pelvic surgery or bypass grafting. So erysipelas is quite common. And with advent of HIV, we get to see lots of cases of erysipelas. Now this erysipelas should be taken care of. It starts with red mottled rash, generally on the trunk, with high-grade fever, chills, fatigue, headache, vomit, and general illness, and within 48 hours of the initial infection, everything develops. So, first, the patient complains of high-grade fever with chills, fatigue, and headache. Over 48 hours, the rash develops. It starts with red mottled rash, and then it becomes confluent. It enlarges rapidly as a sharp, demarcated raised edge, and appears a scarlet red, swollen and warm, hardened and painful, similarly in consistency to an orange peel. And ammon carb would be a drug of choice when this erysipelas is associated with meningitis, what we call as meningococcal infection. Meningitis also brings about this type of rash. In ammon carb, if the infection persists, it results in vesicles and bulli and skin necrosis. Occasionally, a red streak extending the lymph node can be seen, which is called paneuracia. Now, when this stage comes, then the stage of ammon carb is over, and another very, very unthought of medicine, allium sepa, is thought of in this condition. Wherein, I repeat, if the infection persists, it results in vesicles, bulli, and skin necrosis and lymphedema. Occasionally, a red streak extending to the lymph node from the rash to the nearest lymph node, you can see lines extending, and these lines are called as paneuracia. And paneuracia is, if you want to know about the drug, then it is allium sepa. One would not think of allium sepa in such a situation. Fat tissue is most susceptible. So the dermis, below the dermis, there's a fat tissue, and the entire fat tissue is infected when erysipelas occurs. Erysipelas can enter the skin through minor trauma, insect bites, dog bites, eczema, surgical incisions, and it can originate from streptococcal bacteria and patient's own nasal passages. It does not affect the subcutaneous tissue. It does not release pus, but only serum or serous fluid. If it is not taken care of, erysipelas can soon convert itself to cellulitis, and that is a much deeper infection. And you can lose a limb, patient can go into septicemia, and patient can die. So erysipelas needs to be taken care of. We have got wonderful remedies, starting with ammoncarb and Apis, and they really are known to take care of such situations. I have had many patients treated, both when I was doing my medicine in medical college. I have used both of these drugs extensively because you get loads and loads of patients here with erysipelas. And many times you may not, patients may be resistant to many antibiotics, but none of them have I found to be resistant with ammoncarb or Apis.
This is amazing. I mean, just to think, if physicians had the use of ammonium carb, allium sepa, those two tiny little drugs, homeopathically could help so many, I think hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people, all of those people who have undergone, I'm thinking of the people who have undergone surgery, and it goes into the orange peel skin and the swelling and the lymph nodes. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, because in fact, many of these people, they become resistant to certain drugs, the antibiotics are given for 4 days, 5 days, first injectable antibiotics, then they're given tablet form, and they don't work, they don't seem to work. The rash still remains, the fever still remains, and at that time, now they're resorting to homeopathy. But still, even if they resort late, yet we have got these drugs, and Apis never has disappointed me. I mean, really, in any potency I've used, right, I've used in 6 or 30 potency, or in higher potency, 1M, even CM, even millisimil potency, all potencies keep of Apis mellifica have never disappointed neither me nor my family wherever such erysipelas were indicated, or even are indicated now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and we want to just let folks know that this is an educational program. If you do have an immediate health need or a health problem, you need to see a professional homeopath or professional physician for your care. This is simply educational programming.
Exactly. I mean, you should know, and I'm so happy that because of this program, one life is in the hope of being saved in New York.
Yes, it's a chain of events. Just to speak out and inform people, and then they can, one person tells another person. It's like the game of telephone. So this is true. If you have questions, please contact Dr. Adel on his website, homeoacad.org. You can send me an email at homeopathyworldcommunity@gmail.com, and we will give you some contacts of people to get in touch with.
Exactly. So next remedy would be Apis. And again, we have got a rosy red. I've given a picture of a rosy red, sensitive, sore, puffed up skin.
Mm-hmm.
Puffing is very important. Burning is the key for Apis. Ammoncarb does not burn. Apis burns. The patient complains of burning. The patient complains of stinging. The eruptions are generally rough. Whereas in belladonna and ammoncarb, the eruptions are generally smooth. They are sharply demarcated, raised edges are there. They enlarge rapidly, but nonetheless, the eruptions are quite rough to touch. And yes, whether you have it with insect bites, after insect bites, or stings or not, that's a different thing. But yes, any form of urticaria which satisfies this rosy redness, the sensitiveness, the soreness, the puffed up feeling demands Apis. It is the wonder drug. It is the drug of choice. The first drug to be thought of in such types of urticaria. And when we are talking about urticaria, we also should talk about two very important remedies. One is Kali iode, and another is Kali sulf. Kali iode, a grand indication, is pointed out by Cooper. Cooper was a very senior homeopath. and supported by heart lobe and pharynx, is a diffuse sensitiveness over the affected parts. Whichever the area of rash is affected, there is the patient becomes hypersensitive. Time and again, the entire mind of that patient is focused on that area. See, the rash may not be big. The rash may not be very itchy. But the sensitiveness is so much. The mental focus on that rash is so much. It demands Kali Iod. And of course, in Kali Iod, the hives or the giant urticaria is present. And they are present as rough nodules and aggravated by covering. Generally, since we are talking about eruption in the chest, patient would generally want to cover. But a Kali Iod person would hate covering, would roam without anything on the chest. And decidedly better in open air. If the patient says, "Doc, I wish I could throw away my clothes and just be like this in the fan," then you are pointing out to Kali Iod. Characteristic aggravation by covering and decidedly better in open air, it is nothing but Kali Iod. In addition, the rash can present or may have fever with violent sneezing, profuse hot watery nasal catarrh. And Kali Iod is known to act better in pale, delicate subjects who are susceptible to damp and humid climates. So I would always think of Dalka Amara and damp and humid climates. But now, after reading Kali Iod, I should admit that I have also not used Kali Iod to that much extent. I have not respected this remedy as it should be respected. Because before Kali Iod, in damp wet and do humid climates, if a patient gets an urticaria, one would always think of Dalka Amara instead of Kali Iod. But from now onwards, I would also think of this remedy. Dalka Amara is not as sensitive as Kali Iod. It is a rash. It is there in damp wet weathers, damp humid climates. And, of course, it also has got this violent sneezing and profuse nasal catarrh or the flowing of the nose, watery nose, coryza. Urticaria of Dalka Amara is small. I have not mentioned Dalka Amara, but since Kali Iod is there, Dalka Amara and Kali Iod share a very, very close relationship. So Kali Iod is indicated, as I have told you. Another remedy, Kali Sulf, is there. Now, these remedies, many of them are not mentioned in the rubric of rash. But yet, they should be. They are mentioned in different other repertories. But since we are talking about Kent's repertory, folks who are reading Kent's repertory, and they have got this PowerPoint presentation, please add these remedies as well in your books. They are not given, but they needed to be given. Kali Sulf, you have got copious peeling of epithelium and leaves a base moist and sticky. So you don't have raised urticarial rashes. You only have peeling of the skin. Generally, you can have a peeling of the skin in winters or because of exposure to snow. The skin becomes perfectly dry and starts peeling off. And the moment the skin peels off, the base is moist and sticky. Then you should think of Kali Sulf. Then we have got drugs like Bryonia. Bryonia is mentioned in rash. Now, Bryonia, a very, very unthinkable drug for rash. But yes, whenever the rash is slow in development and suddenly recedes, when we see in eruptive fevers, particularly in chickenpox or chicken and measles, it takes 1, 2, or 3 days. And the development of rash is so slow. And sometimes we feel that the rash is partially developed and it will be stopping. In this situation, Bryonia should be given. Particularly undeveloped measles. In technical language or homeopathic parlance, we call it repercussed eruptions. Repercussed eruptions means by certain methodology, by certain ways, the nature is unable to bring out the rash in completeness. You have got the fever, you have got the upper respiratory tract infection, you have partially got the rash, you know it's a measles rash, you know it's a chickenpox rash, but it's been day 1, day 2, day 3, and still rash has not come out. One dose of Bryonia, 30, and you see the very next moment and 2 or 3 hours, it does not even take a day. In 2 or 3 hours, the entire rash comes off. The child or the adult, whosoever is getting rash, feels completely relieved. The economy has thrown away the miasmatic load, and only now you have to wait and watch for the complications. So bryonia is an important remedy to be thought of when you know that the rash is coming, but is not coming fully, and it's about, I mean, it's 3 days or 4 days more, but still the rash has not come up. So you have to think of bryonia. It's given in 2 marks in the chapter of rash. Then you have got another remedy, chelidonium, which is given in 3 marks. Painful red pimples turning into pustules. A very, very common symptom. Chelidonium, 3 marks, but we hardly ever use as far as rash is concerned on the chest. Another remedy which is given, and that's why I've mentioned it, and that is ledampal. Ledampal, rash only on covered parts. Of course, the chest and the abdomen is covered. Rash after puncture wound or bites on chest with edematous rash. Carbuncles on the chest, like the anthracnum and Tarantula cubens. So, ledampal would be more thought of when you have got carbuncle. Now, carbuncle, what is carbuncle? For folks who don't know what is a carbuncle, you have a boil. If a single boil is there, we call it as a furuncle, particularly when it is related to the hair. If it is related to the hair shaft, if there is a pus in and around the hair shaft, and you can see a boil, that boil in technical language is called as a furuncle. And numerous furuncles, they coalesce together, they come together in the form of a sieve or a network. Then this huge big coalition is called as a carbuncle. And a carbuncle, unless otherwise proved, I repeat, a carbuncle, unless otherwise proved, is indicative of diabetes or an impaired immune system. So, it's become a routine. Moment you get carbuncle, it's very easy to diagnose carbuncle. But carbuncles are very, very painful. Carbuncles may or may not bring fever, but they are very painful. They may land up with septicemia, so they need to be treated imminently. And ledampal, people would think of hypersulf, would think of silesia, would think of anthracnum, arsenic, but would never think of ledampal. And that is why ledampal needs to be highlighted when you have got carbuncles on the chest. Should I go on? Hello?
Hello. Yeah, I'm here. Yes, keep going.
Yeah. Then we have got another remedy which is mentioned in the chapter of rash, ipecac. Again, an unthinkable rash. I mean, people, you would think of ipecac in nausea, you would think in vomiting, you would think in pneumonia, but rash, very well. But then ipecac has got miliary rash, small rash, that itches and accompanied with nausea. The patient is forced to scratch himself until relieved by vomiting. A very, very uncommon symptom. Patient is forced to scratch himself until relieved by vomiting. Scratching relieved by vomiting is only there in ipecac. Such rash is seen after delivery or abortions, ameliorated by open air, aggravated by pork, rich food, candy, fruits, raisins, salads, peel and berries. If a person partakes pork, rich food, candy, fruits, raisins, salads, lemon peels, berries, and starts getting such miliary rashes, the patient keeps on scratching and ultimately vomits, then you should not think of any other remedy other than ipecac. Of course, it's quite unlikely to get such a type of this, but if you get a symptom, then ipecac is the remedy.
How often is something like that seen?
It's not seen. It's rarely seen. But whenever it is seen, however rare it is, still homeopathy in its chest has got wonderful remedies for uncommon, peculiar, rare symptoms. And ipecac has given us this rare symptom. Now, since ipecac was mentioned, and that's why I took ipecac, I have never used ipecac. Truthfully, never used ipecac. Never found such patients, basically. So, then we shift on to caladium or American aurum. Is the only drug for erysipelas rare itching rash alternating with asthma. Again, the only drug for erysipelas, itching rash that alternates with asthma. Now this, ladies and gentlemen, is a common phenomena. We may find rashes, we may or maybe erysipelas, may not be erysipelas, but if you find itching rash that alternates with breathlessness or excessive dry cough or bronchitis, it may not be pure asthma, then Caladium is the drug of choice. Again, one would not think of Caladium in a rash. I would think of Caladium for impotency. I would think of Caladium in excessive vaginal itching, for craving of tobacco, but would not think of Caladium in a rash. But then, this entire show, while preparing for this show, I had to read Caladium, and I was wondering, what Caladium is mentioned here. I mean, Caladium is mentioned in two or three places. Articaria, eruption, page number 831, eruptions, articaria, and you have got 2 marks, Caladium as the remedy. So, two or three places Caladium is mentioned. I was wondering how Caladium is used. And thanks to this show, I could learn about Caladium, and hopefully in my practice, sometime I can find use for this beautiful remedy, the American arum.
The more deeply we study, the more tidbits we learn, don't we?
Yeah, and this is actually a method of study. Not even for me, even for people who listen to the show, it's method of study. I mean, sometimes there are remedies, but we don't know. We have never even thought of the remedies. But since we are studying rubric by rubric, subrubric by subrubrics, and then the inquisitive mind wants to know why such drugs are given. We never think of such drugs. But then when you read such drugs, not from one materia medica, but from various other materia medicas, then you know the beauty of such drugs. Camphor, for example. As a sequelae of measles, rash, the skin becomes hypersensitive to touch, to dry, cold and pale. The skin becomes very dry, very cold and very pale. The camphor patient basically hates covering. And camphor has a rash which is called as pityriasis rosea. It's a fungal infection, pityriasis rosea. It starts with a single scaly red and itchy spot. And in a few days, large number of smaller patches on the rash, some red and others tan. They appear throughout the chest. Very, very common appearances in laborers or in people who don't take much care of their hygiene, or females who don't have bath regularly. And such females or such mean males, they land up with such type of pityriasis rosea. Starting with a single scaly eruption, generally at the base of the neck, behind the neck, and it spreads on the entire anterior portion of the chest. Large itchy spots, and they keep on itching. They take on drugs like cetirizine and all, and they don't seem to get well. Some homeopath would think of sulfur, but before sulfur, think of camphor.
So they would need to differentiate. So camphor person is feeling very cold and sulfur is feeling very hot. Is that helpful?
Yeah. Yeah. Sulfur is a very big remedy. Both are very hypersensitive, camphor as well as sulfur. But the clinching point for camphor would be they would feel cold. The skin would be feeling, cold to touch, as well as the patient feels cold and yet hates covering. Even sulfur hates covering. Sulfur does not want covering. Does not come. But what is important with sulfur is sulfur has the typical SAR sweat. The sweat of it is sweaty skin. It's absolutely not dry. Whereas camphor skin is very, very dry.
Very good.
Both are very ugly to look at. I mean, you wouldn't want to look at any of those skins. Sulfur, graphitis, camphor, any of these. But dry and cold, wet and hot.
We have a lot of folks that are listening today. And if you do have any comment or question, please let us know. You can, if you're on the chat, just type in there and phone in to 347-945-6956 or via Skype. Although it looks like our hour is up, so it's up to you whether you want to keep going or you want to save the second half.
I want to continue and finish this off because, it's always the next time. So, I mean, it will take me another 15 minutes.
Okay.
So, Then another, we have got a rubric, sub-rubric in the eruptions rash. One is given red and other is given below the red, it is coppery. And in both of these drugs, you have got Merksol, Mercury solubilis. Now, coppery red eruptions or coppery red rash, in olden times, in times of Hahnemann, of course, we don't see it nowadays. It's a characteristic rash of secondary syphilis. Syphilis basically has become very, very rare. So secondary syphilis, primary syphilis is rare. So secondary syphilis you hardly get to see. And they're typical penny-shaped coppery eruptions 3 to 6 weeks after chancre. After a sexual contact with an affected person, the patient starts getting a chancre. If it's a female, on the genitals of the female or on the male. And moment you get the chancre, 3 to 6 weeks after that, generally on the palms, soles and chest, you have got penny-shaped, numerous penny-shaped coppery lesions, which are multiple. They may start with change of color, but then they slowly become vesicular. The vesicles are filled with pus, so become pustular, moist, irregular spreading shallow ulcers, and moistness is extremely important. The patient has easy and smelly perspiration, but is not relieved from it. It's the perspiration is very sticky, so patient keeps on having a bath and yet is perspires. Moment he or she comes out of having bath, you have a bad smell, as if the patient has never had a bath. It is as similar to as Rumex. Sorry, room, R-H-E-U-M. A room would, I mean, how many times, how many deodorants a person applies or the, how many times he or she has a bath, a room always smells sour. Same with Merksol. I mean, you go and have a bath and the moment you come out, you are actually drenched in your own sweat. So that much sweat is Merksol. And Merksol has got red coppery rash.
I always think of the tongue as being coated and is as a keynote clue. Is that true?
It is true, but Merksol is contraindicated in dry skin. If you have to think of Merksol, you have to think of perspiration, and the perspiration should be free, should be offensive as far as possible. But you cannot administer Merksol in a dry skin person. Even if the tongue is coated, you can have lots of other remedies like Antim Tart and Antim Crude with coated with similar coating as in Merksol. But Merksol requires free perspiration. Itching worse from warmth of bed and night. We all know that. Any eruptions of Merksol would itch, and itching, the entire dissipation would not complain. But definitely, moment he or she goes to the bed, covers with the blanket, and if it's night, even if she or she does not cover, moment the night sets in, then you start having the symptomatology. And many people would say that, see, in doc, the entire day I'm working, so I don't pay attention that to the itching. But moment I'm free, it's not the free, it is the night which calls in for Merksol.
And can you tell me any differential between the Merksol and the rheum?
Yeah, rheum. Of course, now, rheum is a remedy which is a very, very short-acting drug. And a rheum person, basically, a rheum child, you generally think of rheum in a child which has a typical dentational diarrhea and a pharyngitis. But the clinching point from rheum is the offensiveness of the skin. The rheum child or the rheum person would not perspire as much as Merksol. So rheum just smells, whether it is a dry skin or whether it is a wet skin. The entire skin smells. Whereas Merksol is smelly, but what you can remarkably see in a Merksol would be the perspiration, the freeness of perspiration. All discharges of rheum are smelly, but perspiration may not be as much as Merksol. And rheum does not have this characteristic nightly aggravation in any of its forms. It has the aggravation of the rheum is with other reasons, but not nightly. Merksol is characteristically night aggravations or warmth of bed aggravations. All complaints. Even if the person, Moxol, has one eruption or a single eruption, at night the entire body would be covered with eruptions. And the moment he or she gets up in the morning, the eruption will be restricted to one particular part. That is the characteristic, or the what we call as the characteristic syphilitic aggravations of Moxol.
Thank you.
Then we have got a rash of natrum sulph and natrum muraticum. Natrum sulph presents itself as the classical psychotic excrescences of wart-like. They may be wart or they may be wart-like. Red lumps all over the body. Natrum sulph should be thought of eczema, which starts as itchy pimples. Small pimples which itch. And characteristically, the itching is aggravated during undressing. Moment you remove the clothes, moment the patient removes the clothes for having a bath, it is at that time the eruptions itch. Otherwise, they're not. These pimples become moist, ooze profusely, and natrum sulph is a wonderful remedy for eczema, which is accompanied with loose stools, spluttering stools, and humid asthma. So you have concurrent asthma. We actually call eczema as asthma of the skin. Eczema is nothing but asthma of the skin. The same phenomena which occurs in asthma also occurs in eczema. So in many, many patients, asthma and eczema go hand in hand. You tend to have. And both are in open system. For example, asthma is also in the respiratory system, which is open. And skin is a open system also. So if you suppress the skin, you get asthma. If you suppress the asthma, you get skin. If this is going on with a particular patient, one should think of nothing else than natrum sulph. Natrum muraticum, on the other hand, has a drier skin, a greasy skin, an oily skin, and more so on the hairy parts of the chest. And for the characteristic type of dermatitis or eczema, it's called seborrheic dermatitis, wherein you get bumps and swellings near the axillary glands, entire chest is covered, you should think of Natrumur first drug of choice. Again, Natrumur is the drug of choice for herpes, occurring in the flexural areas near the armpits, and the herpes is always accompanied with fever. I have given a small diagram, a small picture of the fever blisters on a greasy, oily skin, especially on hairy parts. This is Natrum muraticum. Then we scale on forwards to silicea. Silica or silicea, the rash is again a form of coppery spots, same as Merksol. The same color as Merksol, but unfortunately, silicea or silica has not been mentioned as a remedy on page number 831 in the eruptions, rash, red or coppery. In both of these sub-rubrics of rash, silicea is missing, but silicea rash is again coppery color, or at the most rose color. Silica is such type of rash is very commonly seen in our country in lepromatous leprosy. Lepromatous leprosy, basically leprosy or Hansen's disease, has become a rarity. But in patients who have got leprosy, I have a patient who is under my treatment since past 2.5-3 years. He is an 86 years old gentleman having frank lepromatous leprosy. And we have used silicea in this gentleman because he has presented us in the form of coppery spots. So this is a personal experience, silica. You also get such type of rash when you have a reaction after vaccination. The rash may end up in an ulcer that discharges offensive pus. So the rash may not remain as rash. Ultimately, it coalesces, it forms an ulcer, and this ulcer does not heal. It keeps on discharging offensive pus. So you can use silicea. Another remedy which again is not thought in context of rashes is manganum aceticum. A wonderful remedy for chronic eczema with amenorrhea in diabetics. Now, many people who are diabetics over 10 years or 20 years, they start developing a complication of diabetes which is called as diabetic dermopathy. Diabetic dermopathy. Like the same way as diabetes affects the heart, the eyes, the kidney and other organs, it also affects the skin, and that affection of skin is called as diabetic dermopathy. During that time, it develops something of a chronic eczema with red elevated spots. And the person keeps on continually itching, which is and keeps on scratching. Along with it, deep cracks are there in the bends of elbows and knees as a result of psoriasis or other disorders. And in such situations, one should avail of Magnum Aceticum. Another remedy which has been mentioned here, rash has been mentioned in Silesia, Staphylococcus, Sulphur, Cephalinum, Leadenpal, Caladium we have done. We are now going to do Nicolinium. Nicolum, flea bites that cause vesicular eruptions with excess itching but not better by scratching. A typical remedy, a very, very small remedy, partially proved remedy. So you have got many times you have got a flea rash or flea bite that causes small vesicular eruptions. They are not as much burning as cantharis. Now, whenever you have a bite, you would first think of cantharis if you have got a blister. But if it is not burning, it is just a vesicular eruption, not going for day in, day out. It's just simple scratching. And the person says, 1 month, doc, that I have been bitten by a flea, but this rash is not going. It does not itch much, but yes, occasionally it does itch. Then you should not think of drugs like cantharis. You should think of drugs like Nicolum.
So many pet owners, do you think it would be great for the dogs and the cats?
Yeah, why not? Why not? Not only human beings, but also in the dogs or even in pet cats. Talking of dogs, I have got two rabbits as my pets. And the female rabbit, she has got this type of rash, and we had given her, I think it was last December 26th or 27th of December, we had given this Nicolum to the rabbit, and the rash is gone. Of course, I don't handle it much, but then I've seen that the rash is gone. So, since you were talking about dogs, it reminded me of my rabbits too.
I think birds also get some kind of a little mite. I don't know whether it would do for
yeah,
other
yeah, anything.
Kinds of...
You can extrapolate this flea bite into anything. I mean, it can be flea bite or insect bite or any other thing. And not only on human beings, but even on animals or birds. So that is perfectly, I mean, as far as suits the vesicular eruptions with itching, not better by scratching, then fine. Newfar luteum. Again, a remedy I would always think of in sexual complaints or somnolence. But it's a master remedy for psoriasis. Psoriatic type of rashes. I have given the flower as well as the typical rash of Newfar luteum, which occurs, has a favorite area on the abdomen and the chest. It begins as red blotches with regular outline, oval to circular, prominently covered with silvery white scales, and violently itching. So much so that the person has to use a brush or something rough and keeps on itching. As the eruption disappears, the scales cease to be produced and the skin at the place of each blotch becomes pale, red or yellowish. And we have seen, in this diagram or in this picture, both of these things are seen. The silvery scale and the place where the silvery scale is not there, it is reddish in color. So this is typical of Newfar luteum. One would not think of Newfar luteum in psoriasis. I bet you would think of any other remedy but of Newfar luteum. And we have tried it in an empty number of cases in our dermatology clinic here. And Newfar luteum really gives very good results in psoriasis, psoriasiform rash, which present this way.
This is a really unusual plant. Where do we have this plant? It's an aquatic plant. Nymphaea?
Yeah.
Native to Europe, Africa, and Asia.
We don't think of it in such disorders. Psoriasis, I mean, unthinkable. You would not think of Newfar luteum. You would think of Newfar luteum for sexual complaints. It's widely predominantly known for that. But it's equally good in psoriasis. Again, psoriasis, for use of nephrolutium in psoriasis is a personal experience. We have used it. Then another common remedy, Artica urens. You think of urticaria and you think of Artica urens. Rather, the word Artica has come from urticaria. Artica urens, sunburn with intense burning and itching, hives with rheumatism after eating shellfish, nettle rash, raised red blotches, herpes labialis, chicken pox, host of drugs. Now, chicken pox, it is not for chicken pox. Although Artica urens, in Materia Medica, it is given for chicken pox. It is not for chicken pox. It is the rash remaining after the vesicles of chicken pox have burst. The pox, the chicken pox, the vesicles or the pustules, they burst open. And after they burst open, the serum comes in contact with the skin, the nearby skin. And that skin develops a rash. So basically the skin, or the patient is sensitive to his or her own secretion, own pus, or own serum. And that is where you would want to use Artica urens. Because it is there, it is that rash which burns intensely and itches also. And lots and lots of people, we have got loads of people who complain of urticaria after eating shellfish. The first drug would come to mind would be arsenic. But rather, if it's urticaria, I would always think of Artica urens rather than arsenic. Arsenic does not have this type of rash. Then we have got... Yeah, we have got... It's
very fascinating.
Two beautiful remedies, Vinca Minor and Viola Tricolor. Vinca Minor, a very, very common plant. I mean, every household in India would have this Vinca Minor. People who have got bungalows, they would tend to have Vinca Minor as weeds. I mean, they wouldn't even care for this drug. But I can vouch for this beautiful remedy. Great sensitivity, redness and soreness of skin from slight rubbing. Chest hair matted together, weeping eczema intermingling with foul, thick crusts. It is one of my favorite remedies for renal failure. I hardly ever is there a patient of chronic renal failure who does not get Vinca Minor from my side. Hardly ever. I mean, it's such good results with decreasing the serum creatinine that And it's not mentioned, it's so unfortunate that none of the Materia Medicas have ever mentioned anything about renal failure in Vinca Minor. And in your uremia, the skin becomes so dry, and so itchy, this is called as typical uremic skin, that the person has great sensitivity and keeps on rubbing and sore. It becomes, slightest rubbing, it becomes red and sore. Unfortunately, in renal failure, you can't even apply any other ointments or Vaseline or for that matter. So what do? I mean, the patient keeps on, instead of the lesser urine, patient is more concerned about the skin. In such situations, you use Vinca Minor. It decreases the urea as well as helps the skin to become lesser sensitive. And of course, the weeping eczema is there. It is another indication for Vinca Minor. Vinca Minor, people who don't know, that's a wonderful drug for renal failure. In fact, today itself I got a patient of nephrotic syndrome, a young boy, aged 5.5 years, and the boy had basically developed, I mean, had taken some drug for vitiligo. And moment he took that drug, he started developing swelling and ascites, swelling of the feet and ascites, high-grade fever, and over a few days, the parents could not understand. So over a few days, they kept quiet. But then the ascites was increasing too much and the fever was increasing too much. Then they showed it to the pediatrician and the pediatrician diagnosed it to be nephrotic syndrome. They are my very old patients. I have cured two or three people of their family and they live quite far from Nagpur. So they came here and said that, "Doc, initially we did go to the pediatrician. He has prescribed steroids, but we don't want to give. You please start with your drug." So, of course, I did start with Apis mellifica, and over a period of time, I would give that child Vinca Minor. Well,
I think of vinca as a cancer remedy.
Yeah,
That's not vinca minor.
It's a very beautiful remedy. Actually, the drug vincristine. Vincristine is a wonderful remedy for leukemia and many other cancers, but breast cancer also is derived from this vinca minor.
Okay.
So it is definitely a drug of choice for cancer also. There are two varieties of vinca minor alba, wherein we have got white flowers, and vinca minor rosacea, wherein you have got purple colored flowers or pinkish flowers. So they are the pinkish flowers or rosacea, which are important for cancer, and the white flowers, not the flower, but the plant, the leaves of those plants bearing those white flowers are important for renal failure and this sensitivity and redness of the skin. So the drug is prepared from the leaves of that plant and not from the flower petals.
We have these all over. They spread like wild. You can't get
exactly.
rid of, you can't get rid of them.
Yeah, but when you want to use them as drugs, they're fascinating, they're lovely. Good. Then we've got Viola tricolor, eczema of childhood, impetigo with intolerable itching, and eczema of childhood, one would think of nappy rash. A very, very common problem, nappy rash, but people seldom, homeopaths seldom ever think of Viola as a remedy of choice. I repeat, it's a remedy of choice for nappy rash. Wherein the child cries because of intolerable itching, but the poor child cannot itch, cannot understand what's happening to it. And that is why it requires Viola. Over a period of time, thick scabs which crack and exude thick tenacious pus develop. That is, again, an indication of Viola. Now, these thick scabs which crack and exude thick tenacious pus is commonly seen when a child receives an injection in the buttock. And if the injection is infected, then you have this type of thick scab which cracks and exudes thick tenacious pus. But Viola for me would be nappy rash. Then we have got Staphylococcus aegaria. I took this picture from Homeopathic World Community itself. You had posted. And we have got eczema, starts as rash, then develops thick scabs that are dry and itchy violently. Scratching changes location of rash and itching. Moment you scratch, the rash changes its position. So this is Staphylococcus aegaria. Of course, not commonly used, but since it was mentioned as 2 marks remedy, I thought it suitable to discuss it. A very, very rare remedy I have discussed, and that is Linum eucitaticum or common flax. And I have given a picture of this linum wherein you have got crop of herpetic rash. Herpetic rash coming in crops one after another. And it is so confident. One blotch from crown to toes with smarting and burning pain. Very rare. You don't get to see such cases. But if you ever get to see, you have a rare remedy in homeopathy, and that is linum. I would go on to kajuputam or kajuput oil, cashew nuts, small red dots on the skin or larger bruise-like spots, which is called allergic purpura, that appear after taking drugs and accompanied with excessive flatulence, esophageal spasms, hiccups, excess salivation, sweating, and the rash causes intense itching. Basically, kajuputam is a drug of choice for drug rash. And I've specifically included a sample slide for certain drug reactions due to antihypertensive remedies. For example, thiazides can cause phototoxic or allergic eruptions. Combination of amiloride or hydrochlorothiazide has the highest recorded adverse drug reactions on the skin. A combination of amiloride and hydrochlorothiazide both are wonderful antihypertensive agents. But if you use such combination, be prepared for an adverse drug reaction on the skin. Furosemide or Lasix are very, very commonly used drugs for congestive cardiac failure or renal failure, causes eczema, purpura, bullous eruptions, and even Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Stevens-Johnson syndrome is the ugliest form or the lethal form of any drug rash. We have got Methyl-Dopa, which is very extensively used during pregnancy for reducing the blood pressure. And many females do get eczema on the hands and feet or a lichenoid type of eruption or purpura. Hydralazine is known for giving a lupus erythematosus like eruptions and urticaria. Beta blockers can cause a morbilliform rash. Captopril may induce itching. But the most serious dermatological side effects, exfoliative dermatitis, is very rarely seen following the use of antihypertensive drugs. I have only taken certain antihypertensive drugs, not all drugs, because it would consume a lot of time. We have discussed about graphitis, psoriasis, mesarium, and sulfur in the last lecture. So finally, I come to rustox, wherein you have a rash which is inflamed, erysipelatous, purple, pitting upon pressure, itches, and aggravated by scratching, burning in eruptions with restlessness, and light-colored patches, that is tinea versicolor. So, with this, we have practically covered all the remedies I wanted to talk about as far as rash was concerned. Of course, we did exceed the time, but I'm happy that we completed at least this sub-rubric of eruptions on the chest. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Adil. This has been marvelous, very educational. I'm sure everyone came away with something new today. And if you enjoyed the show, click the reminder, make it a favorite. Send a message to Dr. Adil. Let him know how much you appreciate the time that he devotes to these sessions and the preparation of the handouts and all that he does. Visit him on Facebook and on his website, homeoacad.org. Thank you so much for bringing waves of awareness about homeopathy and healing to the world today, because not everybody even knows about it. They mistake it for other kinds of therapies, and they don't really understand how it works and its potential.
Exactly. And hopefully, if people can find use, as so many of our patients previously have found use, and they communicate to us, and I'm so happy, I mean, that one of the patients who found my address for her 3-week-old child who's suffering from cardiomyopathy in USA, and only with a single dose of Antemtart, and she cried, she literally cried on the phone, and she said, "This is the first time in 3 weeks, doc, that my child has actually slept the entire night." So, the entire purpose of the entire show is served. I don't want anything else. If it's helping even one single individual, then these shows have served their purpose.
Thank you so much. And have a very good evening. I hope if you haven't eaten yet, you have a good meal and some family time.
Yeah, same to you.
Thank you.
Have a great time ahead. And you have a great trip at New York. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And everyone else who wants to hang in here with me, we're going to continue on for another 30 minutes. Very often, I am learning with Dr. Herbert Roberts, MD, who has written the book, The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy. And we're up to chapter 14. I'm going to check one more time where we are. We were doing the dose. We studied about the dose. That was chapter, let's see, I think we may have gone a little bit further, but let's go ahead and read chapter 14 today. Remedy reaction. One of the first things required of a homeopathic physician is that his powers of observation shall be highly developed. And so this is important. His powers of discrimination should be very keenly attuned, first, that he may observe the patient in the analysis of the symptoms and the selection of the remedy. Second, that he may have the keen perception of the import of the symptoms after the remedy has been carefully selected and administered. So we don't just give a vaccination and say goodbye, go home. You have to sit there and take notes what's going on with the individual, even if it's just to call the client after a day or after a few days and get some feedback. after the administration of the similimum, some actions should result. And the similimum is the matching remedy to that individual's symptom picture. It is upon the development and interpretation of the action of the remedy or the reaction of the vital energy to the remedy that successful prescribing very largely depends. So you want to see what's the reaction of the person. What are we going to expect after the remedy has been administered? I cannot say how many people will tell you that. They'll say, what am I supposed to look for? What am I supposed to expect after I take this remedy? Well, Dr. Herbert Roberts says, according to Hahnemann, the nearer the similimum, the remedy, the more reaction we may expect. And this is written in his Organon of Medicine in aphorisms 154 and 155. If the exact similimum, exactly on target, right matching remedy is found, we're apt to get a slight aggravation before relief comes. So there you're going to see something is happening. You're going to notice some change. On the other hand, if no changes take place, too long patient waiting is useless. For it is evidence that the similimum has not been found. So he expects something to happen almost right away. But the nearer the symptoms of the patient are to the symptoms of the remedy, the more sure we are to have some reaction. It is for us to determine what the reaction means and to interpret it in prognostic terms. We must be able to listen to the patient's report and from it and our powers of observation to determine what the remedy is doing. We know that when the remedy acts, the symptoms will change in either character or degree, whether it's going to change in what form it looks like or in the intensity. There may be a disappearance of the symptoms, amelioration of the symptoms, or increase of the symptoms, and these changes are the manifest action of the remedy on the vital energy or vital force, and it is these manifestations we must study. Among the most common reactions after the remedy has been administered is aggravation or amelioration. Now there are two types of aggravation. So aggravation means that, you know, you're aggravated, it's getting worse, either of which may be manifest. So what are the two types of aggravation? There's the aggravation, which is an aggravation of the disease condition in which the patient grows worse. There may be a very different type of aggravation in which the symptoms are worse, but the patient is growing better. He will say, I feel better, doctor, but such and such symptoms are worse. The aggravation from the disease state is an indication that the patient is growing weaker, and therefore the disease state is growing stronger, while his vital energy is ebbing. So this is not what you would like to see. On the other hand, the aggravation of the symptoms while the patient reports himself as feeling better is an indication that his vital force is being set into order. But individual symptoms may show aggravation. So perhaps they're feeling better, but that eruption is coming out more. Just like Dr. Adil just explained, to find a remedy where he was saying slow, non-forming and completing the eruption was the remedy bryonia. So in this case, it would have helped to see that the person's feeling better, but this particular symptom is worse. We must also observe how the aggravation or amelioration occurs and the duration of these periods. In this connection, we must always bear in mind that is the patient's welfare we are seeking. Always think aphorism number one, to heal the sick. This is to make them comfortable, to make them better. And it is for us to determine whether he is improving or declining. Sometimes he will say that he is weaker, yet on the analysis of the symptoms, you might find that this is not true. So this is really important because you as the physician, as the practitioner, must be able to determine, even though what they say might say they don't feel good, like they're going to say, oh, all of these eruptions are coming out, but in essence, they are improving. The story of the symptoms is often of greater importance than the patient's opinion. After we have assured him or her of the amelioration of his condition and called his attention to the particular instances of improvement, he will be better immediately. So you're encouraging, supporting, letting them know that the direction of cure is moving forward in the right way. And this, they depend upon you to know as a physician. The aggravation, when the patient is growing actually weaker, is a sure indication that the symptoms are taking on a more internal phase and the vital organs are more affected. In other words, it is an illustration of the reversal of the order of cure. In these states, the patient may sometimes declare himself better because of the absence of some trying symptoms. Yet the careful homeopathic observer will know he is worse because the natural cure, course of cure is reversed and the disease condition is attacking more vital organs. And Dr. Herbert Roberts, throughout his writings, has always said from inner to outer. And so if you find the reverse, you find outer to inner, meaning that those skin eruptions suddenly disappeared without having any kind of aggravation, then you might be considering, is the person actually stronger? Is the direction going correctly? Are the eruptions that are suddenly disappearing, meaning that the disease is going to a more vital organ within the human being and that we cannot see what's going on now? By these differentiations, we must know, we know whether the patient is progressing or retrogressing. In many of these cases, there is corroboration between the patient and the symptoms in the mind of the patient himself. And just insofar as there is this corroboration, the truth of his observations is valuable. So just remember, when you do use cortisone cream and you use a steroid and the symptoms and inflammation go away, yes, you might be feeling better in one aspect, but what about the totality of that human being? What's happening inside the person that we now, it's become hidden? We should find whether the symptoms are tending toward the exterior and away from the internal, inner parts. In other words, we should know whether there is a peripheral tendency or a tendency in the reverse order. The aggravation of the disease state may come from an incurable state, which is stirred to its foundations by the potentized remedy. And unless the remedy is counteracted, the disease will become worse and more rapidly approach a fatal termination. In borderline cases, cases bordering on fatal termination, the use of extremely high potencies may react on the vital energy so deeply as to cause an aggravation of the disease. Whereas a more moderate potency, say the 30th or 200th, would not give such dangerously powerful effects. However, no fatal aggravation will occur unless it is already foreshadowed by the symptoms manifest in the patient. The potentized remedy will never produce a fatal aggravation or a destructive aggravation that would not have been possible and even probable from the symptomatology. But it may, and often does, when used without discretion, speed the case to a fatal termination. And this is why we often say, do not use arsenicum album at end of life, at the person who is in hospice, especially in a high potency. Yes, there is anxiety. Yes, there is restlessness. Yes, there is fear of death. But arsenicum album in a high potency will move the person quicker toward their demise. In other words, a single dose of the high potency will not produce disease conditions. It has the power to develop conditions that are already present if it is used carelessly and ignorantly. More careful study might reveal the indications for a less deeply acting remedy, which when administered would greatly mitigate much of the fatal suffering. So Dr. Herbert Roberts tells us, maybe you need to look at other remedies and use gentle, low potencies, maybe even cell salts, tissue salts, 6X, 3X, mother tincture. Maybe something that is going to palliate and give comfort to the patient rather than push the disease to move toward its natural progression. You must remember that we are warned in the Organon to discern what is curative in medicine and also what is curable in disease. So this is what the homeopath must discern, what the physician must discern. What disease is so pathological that we're not going to be able to heal the person completely, but we can palliate, we can give them an ease in their suffering. This point cannot be too greatly stressed, that in profound states, we must be very careful not to stir the vital energy to its depths. So what he's telling us is the person only is in a weakened state. They don't have enough energy source within themselves to push it out, to clear it out, to go and remove the depth of that disease. There should be more time allowed for an attempt at a gradual restoration, as there has likewise been a gradual decline. So you're talking about chronic disease here, something that is occurred over a lifetime, and the person has become weaker and weaker. So boost their energy through other means that you have available in your toolbox, through cell salts, through supplements, through vitamins, through good nutrition, through detox, whatever it is that you can do. Very often, less deeply acting remedies will react and palliate incurable diseases because they act more superficially. They act upon the sensorium and do not act upon the deep recesses of the vital force itself, and yet make the patient much more comfortable by relieving the symptoms annoying through the sensorium, their senses. We can know then whether changes are occurring from the depths of the vital force or whether the patient may recover. The direction taken by the symptoms is the sure indication. In this connection, the first observations is often a prolonged aggravation and a final decline of the patient. Now, just what has happened? Possibly there has been too deep an antipsychotic administered, and this is a miasmatic, hereditary term used in homeopathy and antipsychotic, this outbreak, this skin disease type of affliction, this itching, and it has set in motion the vital energy and developed a destructive process. So when we're talking a destructive process, we're talking about affecting the organs pathologically, that there's a change in the organs, the change in the skin, in turn change in the dermis. And these profound states of incurables, the vital reaction toward cure is impossible. And we can be assured that it is an incurable case. So you need to assess how far along a disease has progressed chronically over decades, over years, to determine whether you can do elicit a cure for that individual in this weakened state. In such cases as these profound incurable conditions, we should avoid giving a high potency. And we may be able to go on and develop the case gradually until later it may possibly react favorably to a high potency. This is well illustrated in advanced cases of tuberculosis. And remember, folks out there listening, tuberculosis now has developed a strain that is resistant to today's medications and antibiotics. So we have homeopathy that still works, no matter if antibiotics don't. Where it is never safe to give a very high attenuation of the exact similimum. So he says it's not good in these deeply developed cases of TB to give a high potency, a high attenuation of the exact similimum. It's sort of like dancing around the similimum, dancing around the disease to prop that person up, give them supports first so that they build their immunity. It is probably wiser not to use an antipsychotic in these conditions. However, this applies only to those who are profoundly ill with chronic troubles. In cases where there is not so profound a disturbance after the remedy has been administered, then you will see the aggravation may be long and severe. Yet the final reaction and amelioration comes. And this takes a tremendous amount of patience on the part of both the homeopath on the patient. Sometimes in these states, the aggravation may even last for weeks. And, you know, today we think weeks, that's not so long. But when he expects a quick response and a quick reaction and development toward cure, he maybe is saying personally, yes, this aggravation may last for weeks. And you know, when a person doesn't feel well and they're having this intensity of symptoms, it's difficult to get through one day at a time. Yet, improvement in general is continually taking place. And this is where you use your powers of observation. If you're seeing improvement, even a little improvement, whether it is appetite improvement, energy level improvement, you know this is good. And then comes the amelioration and slow but sure recovery, so that the second observation would be a long aggravation but final, although slow, improvement. In these borderline cases, there has already been established some marked organic changes, and where pathological changes have actually taken place, the period of aggravation will be longer. And I'm just going to check, folks, if you're still listening, you are, and if you have any comments, just let me know. I will check from time to time if you have anything written in the chat. In these borderline cases, there has already been established some marked organic changes, and where pathological changes have already taken place, the period of aggravation will be longer, but the general improvement in health in the curable cases will be manifest. In other words, you're going to see, you're going to know, it's going to be obvious if things are improving. Then there is another reaction where the aggravation, this is another type of response that you're going to possibly see, where the aggravation is quick and short and strong, with rapid improvement of the patient. When you find such a reaction to the remedy, you will always find rapid improvement. So you can see, like in the belladonna case, he said, belladonna is quick acting, it's quick to develop the disease, and it's quick when you give the correct remedy of belladonna to see the response. Whereas in the bryonia type of patient who needs bryonia, the development of the disease is slow and the response is slow, but in the right direction. The reaction is vigorous when you have this type of quick, short, and strong aggravation. And there has been structural changes. They have been of a superficial nature and near the surface and not of the vital parts. Okay, so he's saying this is going to be observable. It's going to be on the skin. It's going to be on the tongue. You're going to see it in the eyes. You're going to see it manifest. He's even giving an example here of furunculosis or abscess formation on the surface. So it's like this volcano. It's like something that is erupting. The patient is really working hard. The vital force of that patient is working hard to push out the disease, the toxic matter, the foreign matter from the body, whether it was started from a bacterial infection or a viral infection, no matter what it was, or even an emotional etiology, no matter what it was, if it's on the surface, it's superficial nature, and not deep within the vital organs, the brain, the lung, the liver, the heart, the kidneys, these organs, then if you see this quick, short, and strong aggravation, you're going to see a rapid improvement. And these are surface changes and are not comparable to the effects of the changes in the deeper organs, like the kidney, the heart, or the brain. It is well to take note of the difference between organs changes that take place in the vital organs that sustain the economy. And I'm hearing some beeps, and I see, oh, Dr. Wakwar, thanks for joining. You will be able to hear the archive after we finish today's show. And I'm just doing a reading of Dr. Herbert Roberts. We're talking about responses to the different remedies that are given and the level of vital force in the individual. Again, there is another class of indications where we find no aggravation whatsoever. Okay, so this is a different response, no aggravation. There's no organic change and there's no tendency to organic disease. The chronic condition causing disturbances to which the remedy is applicable is not at a very great depth. It belongs to the functional conditions. Okay, so he's teaching us the difference between pathological, deeply developed changes, organic changes, and functional conditions, exhibiting its effect in the nervous manifestations and the relations of the patient to his surroundings and to tissue changes. There are changes in the vital force that are so profound as to cause many symptoms that are very trying to the patient, and yet so slight that with all the instruments of precision, we do not observe any pathological changes. Isn't this interesting? Have you ever had an itch and scratched it, and you look and look, and there's nothing there, but your body is speaking to you? There's no pathological change. Yet, we have these sensations. We're susceptible to our surroundings, and there have been no tissue changes yet, but there is something affecting us. And this is the beginning stage. It is functional conditions. It is in these conditions that we sometimes get considerable suffering, yet cures will come without any aggravation. In these cases, the single remedy in a moderate potency, and he calls a moderate potency a 200 centesimal, will probably complete the work. In such cases, we know the potency and the remedy are correct. And you're really, really fortunate if you come upon cases like this, that you only need to give one dose in a moderate potency, a moderate attenuation, and realize that there's no intensity of the symptom, no aggravation, and yet now the patient is feeling back to normal. Then we have some cases with amelioration coming first and aggravation coming afterward. This amelioration comes on to last usually for 3 or 4 days. The patient seems to be better, but at the end of the week or 10 days, all the symptoms are worse than when they first came to you. These are usually cases that have a great many symptoms. We find that in spite of what we thought at first was a favorable reaction, the ultimate condition is unfavorable. So here he's saying another response from the individual. Looks like things are going good. You've got things are ameliorating or feeling better initially for 3-4 days, but then the condition gets worse again. Either we selected too superficial a remedy, so you didn't get the right remedy. That could act only as a palliative, or the case is incurable and the remedy has been somewhat similar, but not completely the similimum. In order to determine the cause of the reaction, we must examine the patient and find out whether the symptoms related to the remedy or to the disease. Okay, so he's saying these symptoms that are coming out now, is this because it's approving of the remedy, it's the remedy symptoms that are starting to come out, or is it the disease symptoms that are starting to come out? And remember what he said previously in this chapter, that, you know, the disease is going to, we might be progressing the natural course of the disease as well. So that's when he says, don't do the similimum in cases of incurables. And then you do want to do something just similar, but not exact. Sometimes you will find the remedy was an error. Okay, homeopaths, yes, we do make mistakes. We do select the wrong remedy, and usually nothing will happen. But in this case, he says, first you're going to see something good happen. It's going to appear good. It's going to appear like an amelioration, but the symptoms will return. So that's the wrong remedy. You will find usually in these cases that the remedy was similar to the most pronounced symptoms, but it did not cover the whole case, and therefore it did not strike at the constitutional state of the patient. Okay, you covered some of the symptoms, some of the major keynotes, but it wasn't the right remedy. Here, in evaluating the symptoms, we missed the essential concomitants. This is something that Dr. Herbert Roberts loves, concomitants. different symptoms that are occurring simultaneously. And we based our prescription on the generals only. So he likes to have generals. He likes to have concomitants. It may be that we have an incurable patient. It will be fortunate for such cases if the symptoms come back exactly as they were when you first saw the case. But the symptoms often come back changed. Okay, so this is really an important point. If after the amelioration, the symptoms return exactly as they were before you gave the remedy, that's great. You want to hear that because nothing's changed. You just didn't get the right remedy. You made them feel better a little bit with a little palliation, but you're back to your starting point. And then you can retake the case and look. But if the symptoms have come back changed, then something's happened. So he says, we must wait, and this will require patience on the part of the physician and cooperation on the part of the patient. It may be necessary to take the patient into your confidence, and I'm going to check and see. Okay, so we have questions on the chat, and we will ask about that for next time, about lupus, Dr. Wakwar. It's a good question. So we're continuing with Dr. Herbert Roberts, and what kinds of changes that we might expect in a patient when they're given a homeopathic remedy. And waiting is really, really important. It's a very hard thing to do, but he says wait. This will require patience on the part of the physician and cooperation on the part of the patient. So this is why sometimes we may lose the patient. They may get frustrated. They may get irritated. They may get aggravated. And then they go ahead and get some kind of steroid or antibiotic or something to relieve their suffering. They're going to search out something. So this is why it's so important to know the potential responses and bring the patient into your confidence if he evinces sufficient intelligence to warrant it. So he's saying that sometimes you can convince the patient, let's keep going, this is what happened, and explain the situation. The higher potencies will set in motion in the vital force curative functions, which will act a long time. Because oftentimes, in these chronic conditions, it takes a long time to establish order. And the vital energy takes its own time to cure. So lots of times the patient will say, how long is this going to take? What am I going to expect? And you know, each person is an individual. You don't really know what's going to happen until you start to observe it. During the process of waiting, no medicine should be given. Just bring the patient into your confidence, explain what you're expecting, explain what's happening, that sometimes if you've had an illness, a chronic illness for decades, for a lifetime, whether it is asthma or arthritis or whatever it might be, or psoriasis or eczema, that you're working, the body is doing its best, working to push the disease out, and this might be slow. In cases that are proceeding to a perfect cure, if the improvement continues for some time and then suddenly comes to a halt, find out if the patient has been doing something that is against the rules of health or has interfered with the continuation of the curative action of the remedy. So this is what Hahnemann might say are blocks to cure, things that have happened in a person's life, whether it is a trauma that suddenly interfered, an accident, or maybe they have come upon an influenza or a contagious disease, or if they're not eating properly, they're just eating tons and tons of sugar. You know, these things are not going to be helpful. And, you know, we've come to the end of today's show, and we're very, very close to the end of this chapter. As I was reading it, I also realized that I read this chapter last week. So you can hear it either last week, the second half of this chapter, or just read it on your own. I have it listed in last week's archive. And this has been really, really very enlightening, worthy of two listens, three listens, four listens, so that you can get it into your method of thinking. And so we're going to go ahead and end today's show. And I want to thank everyone so much for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow, Alan Phillips, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Vaccinations and Your Rights. And next Thursday with Dr. Adil, we will be surprised as to what we're going to learn. Although we have been doing erysipelas, so maybe we're going to go into excoriation of the chest in Kent's repertory. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Heart Health and Homeopathy on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We encourage you to follow our show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when the show airs, and share with friends on Facebook and Twitter. Please send in your comments and questions, and we'll see you next time.